Some people say that you don't really understand life until you've seen what they call hard times. And I don't know if I've ever really seen hard times, nor am I really sure how to describe them. All things being equal, I don't think any two hard times really look anything like each other. Different circumstances lead to different conditions, and the systems that sustain our lives can break down in different ways. Gravity holds us to the earth. The moon holds the tides in their rhythms, and the spin of the earth holds our days and nights, and only God knows what else goes on in the cosmic abysses that keep us breathing and moving and talking. Our social lives keep us motivated, keep us to an extent in good health, and it is in love that we even see glimpses of what might lay beyond these humdrum clockworks that keep our reality ticking along. We have a common sense idea of what hard times are, although God never pulls the plug on these day-to-day facts and laws of physics. Sometimes it seems he playfully pokes at the structures we hold so dear so that we can momentarily perceive how fragile they are. And yet here we are. And God gives us smiles, even on the faces of infants, and the knowledge that things are okay, or if they aren't, that they will be. The signs and signals afforded to us in our own perception can be lost, though, or sometimes go unnoticed. So 15 years ago, I was lost, in terms of spirituality, more than I could have known at the time or would presently like to admit. I mainly relied on my own perceptions of reality, the truths that seemed to fit in ways that could get me through the day in a way that I could stay afloat, emotionally speaking, were the ones I clung to. I fit together broken puzzle pieces, snippets from this religion here and that philosophy there and that mysticism over there into a patchwork raft, which I floated on in the oceans of my life just fine for a while. But in the end, it didn't keep the water out. It was, sadly, Christ that was missing from it all, the glue that would have held it together. As it says in Colossians 1:7, by him all things hold together. In the end, he was somewhat present, but not enough. What was holding me back from him or keeping my back turned? That glue that would have outshone every other part of what I'd built, and when the raft broke, I found myself hospitalized and with a mental illness diagnosis, not having the foggiest idea of how to proceed. From nowhere, this problem-solving brain of mine that I've come to rely on for so long and even take for granted to stitch everything together had slipped into the realm of the untrustworthy. I suddenly needed desperately and unavoidably a salvation that somehow had gotten past me, that of the love of Jesus Christ that had somehow not made the cut into the forefront of my spiritual thinking. I literally could no longer to continue to function as someone focused so deeply on spirituality. The strange thing was that I was exposed to so much activity around the church when I was young, youth group, praise bands, even a national youth gathering. The problem was that I hadn't made it personal. I hadn't connected my own will to the truth and found faith and hope. So when the dam broke in my brain, or some doctors likened it to a bonfire, all of that high intellect and worldly wisdom came rushing over my day-to-day functionality and left me hardly able to speak. Now, I don't want to devalue the importance of understanding other spiritual practices and belief systems, but what I'm pointing out here is without the one that has become central to me and the one we're here to celebrate, the capstone in our lives, it was somehow missing during the time before my collapse. And my collapse probably wasn't due to this collection of other spiritualities and practices, although in the time where I was literally struggling for my sanity, those teachings abandoned me in fear of the demons I now faced in my week-to-week medicated life. The Bible reading for today sees an interesting situation in the lives of three slaves turned scholars after being captured by a conqueror of ancient times. This was obviously before the internet, television, or even printing presses, so things like the Bibles in our pews in their present forms wouldn't have even been available to them, partly because many of the events recorded there hadn't been written down yet. They would have relied on their memories to understand the world around them in relation to their religion, having possibly memorized the early laws and teachings of their own spiritual world. They would have had the wisdom to respect the authority put over them until it conflicted with the integrity of what they'd been taught from youth. They would have been very conflicted to become wise men of another culture's measure. And yet I believe that their faith and a strong foundation in their beliefs, the hope of their lives, would have kept them waking up day after day to serve a foreign master from a foreign empire and fill their lives and minds with knowledges not necessarily true in real ways to them. Their hearts would have been suffering, and they would have had sleepless nights and long days and a constantly confusing experience. That is, if they lacked confidence in the teachings that had brought them up. However, we know better than some of this. We know the story, and we know that when they wouldn't deny their God, they walked through the flames of their death sentence in one of the most amazingly calming miracle images of the Old Testament, totally unscathed. One of the times I was hospitalized, for maybe a third time, I found a red-letter Bible in my bedside table, and I realized that there were some things I didn't know, finally, at the age of 24. So I opened it. If you don't know what a red-letter Bible is, it's the kind where all the words of Jesus are written in red, ink, and with everything else in black. I read the red letters exclusively at first throughout the New Testament with a thirst, longing, and desire that I'd never believed to be possible or real when I'd heard others describe it. My rebellious heart began its slow and what I hope will be lifelong turning and honing in that moment of my life. I was blown away by the telling of the Good Samaritan in Luke 10 that I hadn't quite grabbed onto before, where the neighbor we're told to love is someone who we can offer something to and not necessarily receive anything in return from. That was this love. Love subverts what we think a relationship is and takes every opportunity to remind us that it is in filling the needs of others that we find ourselves fulfilled. And I was really rocked when I began to understand that the gift of Jesus' life, not just his death, but his entire life, was given towards the salvation of mankind. Any other ambition or hope or dream he may have had was set aside. And as he said the words, "No greater love has a person than this, to give his life to his friends," in John 15:13, I had to rub my eyes a little and re-understand what Jesus was really about. He didn't naturally and ambitiously march towards martyrdom, but actively gave of himself all of the time during his ministry. His very life was an act of service, every breath. So I was in the hospital, in the dark, crouched over the Bible with a flashlight for hours at a time. Christianity and the teachings of Jesus Christ gradually unseated all of the other belief systems I had stitched together. And while those teachings do have value, they pale in comparison to the truth and healing I've experienced in my thoughts since then. And that the Jesus who I was vigorously getting to know through those words in red spoke an otherworldly calm and hope into my life. Just like he was there for those three wise men, his words kept me safe from some of the more dangerous flames in my mind. Now, this isn't a story of a miraculous and overnight healing fix. What I'm saying is that I know from the depths of that confusing time, my soul found the truth in life's most important way, that of real love and real hope. To my surprise, I found some big picture answers in a book that had been handed to me time and again in my life. I was raised Lutheran, so First Communion, Confirmation, and even my graduation saw new Bibles in my hands. Though I hadn't taken up a study on my own until that moment in the hospital, yanked out of the working world and the flurry of my life at the age of 24. In my own personal furnace of the mind, between changes in medications and long discussions of developing symptoms, I found a strange new peace deep down, even when my mind was frantic. The minds of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are truly admirable. Even through this short snippet in the documentation of the times of the prophet Daniel, their lives are an example of stepping into what they believed was true and right, under tremendous social pressure to do otherwise. Their words of dedication and devotion to our loving God are inspiring. "Yet we will praise our God, our love and hope, even if we aren't spared from this terrible fate." I have to think of the Apostle Peter in this story, knowing full well how water tends to behave and yet stepping obediently onto it. Or King David, knowing his rightful role and yet waiting for years and years with opportunities to seize it, waiting for the ordained time for him. They knew the heart of the Lord, that life bringing an otherworldly love, and sincerely wanted its will to be worked. There's a proverb that comes to mind, Proverbs 14:12. "There's a way that seems right to a person, but its end is the way to death." Sometimes it's when we do what doesn't seem right, like these three wise men walking through the flames of their death sentence, that we find hope. and the consequence of their loyalty to the God who is love was salvation. Let me say that again. The consequence of their loyalty to the God who is love was salvation. In a way, I stubbornly still think that in some ways I had the right idea, and I don't think my life came apart because God pulled the plug on what I had made. Under the surface, the truth of my life was that I needed help, and had been focused on doing things in my own way, so focused that a sort of denial had set in that anything could be really wrong or broken with me. And when things began to crumble, God's love was there, and I realized that I had been seeking the wrong kind of truth. And I don't know if one really needs to see hard times in order to really understand things in life. But I do know that in my own life, love was there in an immediate way when reality itself felt beyond hope. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had certainly seen hard times in their lives. Their entire nation was taken captive. Their very names were changed. And what we think of as their lives or their livelihood would have been ruined. And they were taken into captivity to serve foreign powers. Yet when things did get far beyond their control, that's when love showed up. And that's when things got beyond, and when things got beyond my control, that's when it walked safely with me through the bonfire of my mind and out the other side, where at age 37, I'm gainfully employed, married, and have a dog. Don't get me wrong, I still fight for my sanity, and sometimes I long for those nights hunched over the red letters, soaking up every word as if for the first time. I'm not perfect or complete, and I certainly have a lot yet to learn, but my point is, most importantly, love shows up when we need it, invites us into love via our own need for love, and then invites us to be love in the lives of others as well. Meanwhile, gravity holds us down, the earth keeps spinning and the tides move back and forth, the wind blows, and somehow life is sustained. And life seems to fall apart for different people in different ways, but God never pulls the plug. And I give thanks for this when I remember to, and try to grow toward that love that isn't distant, indifferent, or cruel. As humans, we desperately need a social love, one that we can directly experience. And that's one wonderful thing about the Bible. We don't have to follow it word for word and wear sandals as Jesus did in order to follow him, but we do have the opportunity to love as he and so many others did before him in our lives. For me, at that time, love looked like a friend knocking on my door and inviting me out for a walk after I'd laid in bed for 48 hours. "Put on your shoes," love said. It looked like a friend inviting me to a party, not expecting me to speak or smile. It asked me how I was and listened to what I had to say. It let me know that sometimes you have to admit that things aren't okay and believe that they can be okay again. It sat with me. It told me to trust. And love invited me onto the back porch to watch springtime when I couldn't handle anything else, and to come along to church, even when words didn't make sense anymore due to medication and despair. That didn't stop love from inviting me into community with it, even if just by my own presence. And sometimes I found it in a bedside table or simply within. Love does this. It continually begs us to become more and more the love that is in the world, more and more and more. It invites us to show up, loving, and walking through what seem like flames in others' lives when things get too rough to handle alone.